Hello and welcome to another edition of Eye on the Middle East, a weekly podcast produced by NeonTommy.com at USC Annenberg Digital News. Today is April 13th, 2011, and I am your host, Benjamin Gottlieb.
And I am your co-host, Arzu Rezvani. On today's program, the International Conflict Group on Libya and growing concerns over a Gaza aid flotilla. Joining us for the second segment is Sandy Tolan, an author and professor of journalism at USC Annenberg.
The Eye on the Middle East podcast can now be found on iTunes. Just search Neon Tommy, Eye on the Middle East. The International Contact Group on Libya has agreed to set up a temporary trust fund to help the international community channel assets to the opposition National Council in Benghazi. The financial mechanism being set up will allow international donations to be made, possibly from frozen assets of the Gaddafi administration, and made directly available to Gaddafi's opponents. So Arzu, what exactly is the Contact Group?
Well, dubbed the International Conflict Group on Libya, this group was formed at an international ministerial conference in London just a couple of weeks ago at the end of March, and includes European powers, the U.S., and allies from the Middle East, and a number of international organizations as well.
Yes, and I've heard reports that this group hasn't exactly ruled out supplying the rebel group with weapons. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. There was a summit in London late last month, and at that point, a number of key questions were left unanswered, one of the biggest one being whether or not the group should, or legally can, because of Resolution 1973, supply weapons to Libya's rebel fighters. It was reported today that William Hague, the British Foreign Secretary, said that arming Benghazi-based fighters would not be contrary to international law. And I'm going to quote him here. He says, "The UN resolutions do allow for the provision of weapons, but we are making our contribution through our own military, as well as providing non-lethal support such as communications equipment."
So they're kind of going under the rug with this a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, this just shows you how complex this situation is. As you can see, the issue of whether the group can arm the rebels is in large part a legal one that has been complicated by the language used in the resolution, which includes this section about tightening enforcement of the arms embargo, but also includes a clause reportedly inserted at the request of the U.S. that may create a loophole in the arms embargo that allows for the arming of the rebels. Growing concerns over a Gaza aid flotilla planned for May intensified Tuesday as Israeli government reached out to Turkish officials to help prevent an incident similar to last year. Israeli security forces have been preparing for the arrival of another Gaza flotilla for months, drawing on lessons from the controversial raid on the Turkish Mavi Marmara flotilla last May. They expect more than 1,000 leftists and pro-Palestinian activists aboard roughly 20 ships to participate in this year's envoy. So, Ben, do you expect the international community, and Turkey in particular, to block this?
Well, you know, I think it's very ironic that the Israeli government is now turning to Turkey, of all nations, for help in stopping a flotilla. I mean, it was 8 Turkish nationals and one American citizen who happened to also be Turkish that were killed aboard the Mavi Marmara last May. And this was all predated by lots of political disagreements between Israel and Turkey at the Davos conference in Greece. So it's very interesting that Netanyahu is reaching out to Turkey. And I think it's almost, I think it can be interpreted as political posturing. Israel is often in the media, more so than I would argue than a lot of nations in the world. They're under the gun, and rightfully they should be. But with that said, they have to be seen as taking preemptive measures and being proactive about stopping what they consider a threat to to Israeli security. So, yeah, I don't think that Turkey in particular is going to respond positively to this request. But it was something also important to note. In Jerusalem a day prior, on Monday, Netanyahu met with leading members of the EU from Britain, from France, from other European nations with the same request. And I think that we will see in the upcoming weeks some international pressure for the flotilla, for the planned flotilla to not happen. And again, a flotilla is not just one ship. Flotilla is a collection of ships.
That's
something we need to understand. They're planning 20 ships and over 1,000 people. Those are the estimates.
And now, what about the U.S.? Where do they stand in all of this?
Well, again, the U.S. has a vested interest in what happens in Israel. And As we see time and time again, even if there is something that goes against U.S. policy, the U.S. will almost, without fail, support Israel in their interests. And it's going to be really interesting. I really can't see the argument. I can't see how the Obama administration can argue that humanitarian aid should not be trickled into Gaza. There is no question. There have been numerous reports that what we have in Gaza is one of, if not the biggest humanitarian rights problems in the world today.
Right.
And so I can't see how the U.S. and Obama, who especially the Obama administration, who have been tooting protection of the citizens, especially in the Middle East with Libya,
with right.
Egypt, I can't see how they can justify what not allowing humanitarian aid, which is needed and not getting to Gaza, how they can justify blocking that without contradicting themselves. So, but then again, what do I think is going to happen with the United States? I think they're going to do what they've done historically. They're going to support Israel. And it's really a sad thing because the hypocrisy of the U.S. government and even on the part of the Obama administration, which I've outspokenly been a big fan of Obama. It's just awful. It's really awful. Let's take a quick break and remind everyone that you are listening to Eye on the Middle East. I am your host, Benjamin Gottlieb.
And I am your co-host, Arzu Rezvani. Sandy Tolan joins us in the next segment to discuss Israel amid the unrest in the Middle East. Sandy Tolan is a radio and print journalist who has reported from more than 30 countries and authored two books, including The Lemon Tree, An Arab, a Jew, and The Heart of the Middle East. Tolan has written for more than 40 newspapers and magazines, produced hundreds of documentaries and features for NPR and Public Radio International. A central focus of his work has been the intersection of land conflicts, racial and ethnic identity, natural resources, and the global economy. Sandy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, good to be here.
You wrote a piece for Al Jazeera English recently, and there was a line that really struck me. You spoke to Nader Saeed, a Palestinian pollster and a political analyst, and he said, quote, Fatah and Hamas have failed Palestinian society. And he went on to further say that it's the youth that represents the pulse and conscience of Palestine. Can you talk a little bit more about that great divide between Palestinian leadership and the youth?
It's between Palestinian leadership and youth, and also between a lot of other Palestinian people and their leadership, whether it's in Hamas in Gaza or in the West Bank with Fatah. I mean, there's a sense in the West Bank, especially where I've spent a lot of time in the last few years, that Fatah is no longer representing the real interests of the Palestinian people. The people that I talk to and many people on the ground feel that Fatah has not delivered. They did not deliver the peace that was promised. Palestinians see what happened in the Oslo process as representing a huge compromise, a historic compromise. For generations, Palestinians wanted all of Palestine. They wanted Arab and Jew to live together, the sense that they could return to their homes after the 1948 war and the dispossession of Palestinians. So when Oslo came, it basically represented, although a lot of people did not give up their sense of the right of return to their homes that they lost in 48, there was nevertheless a sense that, okay, we're willing to give up this dream of all of Palestine and having a singular secular democratic state and agree to a state on 22% of the land that we always fought for, which is essentially the West Bank and Gaza. So the compromise, the so-called historic compromise from the Palestinian perspective was, okay, now you deliver that to us, right. You Fatah, you leadership. And instead, of course, we've got a fractured reality there with Fatah and Hamas enemies, basically, and the disjointing of the land itself. And the people are like, And we still have an occupation. 60% of that 22% of the West Bank, 60% of that 22% of the land is under military occupation. So the youth are like, okay, enough is enough. These negotiations are getting us nowhere. We have to return to the Palestinian narrative, and we have to create our own reality. And you're either going to come with us or, you know, get out of the way. That's what a lot of the youth are saying. And even though they're relatively small, they're very energetic. Now, whether they're going to be, you know, their energy is going to be enough to, you know, compare them to the Palestinians, to the Egyptians in Tahrir, I mean, notwithstanding what's happened over there in the last couple of weeks.
But,
but there's a sense that that from the Palestinian perspective, that they would say, look, we haven't gotten what you've promised us. Now, you know, let's have a unified agenda of unity among all Palestinians, and an end to negotiations, or get out of the way, Fatah. And so there's a great deal of resentment of the leadership now.
Okay, so I want to push this point a little bit more forward. As Palestinians watch their regional neighbors continue to fight for democracy, would you say that the pressure to see reform within the PA has increased substantially? And if so, what are those indicators?
Well, they've increased in the sense that, you know, you have, like in other parts of the Middle East, you have young people who are using social media and to create sort of up-to-the-moment demonstrations. They decide where their demonstrations are going to be located like 2 or 3 hours before, you know, they get the word out. But some of those demonstrations have been pretty small lately, and there's a sense that you know, maybe the momentum is waning a little bit, like it is in other places. So, but there is a strong indication among not just the youth that a lot of people want to see the Fatah and the leadership and the Palestinian Authority reform itself from within, so that. So that the occupation can end. I mean, the main goal of most people living in the West Bank is let's end the occupation. And although it has lessened under Mahmoud Abbas and recent, including some recent measures by Israel to lessen the number of blockades and checkpoints, there's still a sense that they haven't delivered enough. And the indications, it's kind of mixed at this point, whether they're actually going to move forward with the kind of agenda that they feel will meet, you know, lead to a real sovereign state at some point.
So Sandy, returning to what you said about corruption in your first comment, with what we've seen unfold in the Middle East over the course of the last few months, where does that put the two-state solution?
Well, two-state solution has been in trouble, in my view, for a long time. And that is mostly because of the famous facts on the ground. If you look at one of the ironies of the peace process, the Oslo process, which began essentially with the handshake on the lawn between Arafat and Rabin in the White House lawn in 1993, at that time there were about 109,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank. We're not including East Jerusalem, just in the West Bank outside of East Jerusalem. Now, after all of this peace process, there are more than 300,000. So the number of settlers has actually tripled during the peace process.
Wow.
All of these roads, which are essentially reserved for many roads that are essentially reserved for the settlers themselves, are have just expanded into a big network. You have a city, essentially a city of Ariel, which is one-third of the way into the West Bank. The wall now goes inside the West Bank to encompass this city, which is a settlement. And so the physical obstacles to a two-state solution are now really huge. In addition, now there are so many political obstacles. The Palestinian Authority basically has no peace team after the revelations in the so-called Palestine Papers and the fact that the Palestinian leadership is making the point that Israel made of the Palestinians for many years, was we have no partner for peace. Right. It's not hard to make the case that the Netanyahu government is not interested in the same kind of deal that even the rather accommodating Palestinian leadership rejected from the previous Israeli government, because that included keeping settlements like Ariel and Male Adunim Adumim, rather. And so between the physical obstacles and the political obstacles and the current Israeli government and the weakness and the divide within Palestinian society and the weakness of their leadership, it's really hard to imagine, like, how is this going to happen? Now, one way that a lot of people say, well, the Americans have to be strong. The Americans have to get in there and really support both sides. Now, Israel is the strong party here, right? Israel is a nuclear power. Israel has a military occupation of the Palestinians. So some people say, well, look, then the Americans have to actually, you know, get behind and so at least give the Palestinians some support to try to level the playing field. Yeah. But recently, when the Palestinians just tried to get Israel to get a vote in the Security Council, the Americans sided with Israel, and so
they always sided with Israel.
But this was a particularly strong case in which it was just a matter of condemning the settlements, which is stated U.S. policy, that the U.S. would not vote in support of its own stated policy. And so at that point, the Palestinian leadership said, okay, you know, we actually don't see the point in going forward. So the question now is whether the Americans would actually shift their position. One interesting thing that's happening now that's really worth watching is that the Palestinian leadership under Mahmoud Abbas and Salam Fayyad basically set aside a two-year program in September of 2009 saying, we're going to do a state-building process and we want to show the world that we are ready to have a state. We are responsible. We're going to reduce corruption. We're going to focus on security issues and so on. And they've done a lot of that. So now that two-year program is ending in September of 2011.
Right.
So the question is, will the Palestinians unilaterally declare a state?
Mm.
If they do, will the United Nations support that? Already, I think it's 9 Latin American countries have written and come forward. Will other member states, what will the United States do? The United States can't veto this because you vote for a new state in the General Assembly, right, not in the Security Council. If the United Nations votes in support of a Palestinian state in September 2011 or afterwards, what will that do to the political dynamics? Maybe that's the way that there would be some sort of two-state solution, but it would be not the ideal way to establish it because you still have those facts on the ground that I was talking to you about.
Right.
Yeah. So speaking of upcoming dates, at the end of May, it's going to be the one-year anniversary of the Mavi Mar Mara. And recently, Netanyahu's kind of been on his own campaign going around to EU leaders. And actually just yesterday, he ironically went out and asked the Turkish government if they would help in blocking an upcoming flotilla, which is planned to be bigger. There are reports that there are going to be 20 ships and more than 1,000 activists. Sandy, do you think it's ironic that Israel is now turning to Turkey this year to try to stop the flotilla from coming into Gaza?
A little bit, yeah. I would say so. I mean, given the context of the last couple of years of the rupture, I don't know if I would say a complete end to Israel-Turkish relations. I mean, they haven't completely ended that. But, you know, starting a couple of years ago when Erdogan, the prime minister of Turkey, stormed off the stage in Davos after this long speech and rambling speech by Shimon Peres defending the Gaza war and Israel's actions in the Gaza war, and he walked off the stage in Davos, and then there was a humiliation of a Turkish diplomat by an Israeli foreign minister, senior official, and so on. And then, of course, the big thing being the flotilla itself. And some of the statements that Erdogan made after that would lead you to think that they would never talk again. Now, you know, people make public statements and then there's private things at the same time, obviously. But this seemed more, you know, even if it was a public statement, it seemed calculated to have Turkey be sort of the hero and the role that, you know, Gamal Abdel Nasser played with Egypt in the 1960s, which is, you know, a lot of Arabs saw him as an Arab hero, of course. It was a huge. He was a precursor to a huge defeat, but Erdogan. When I was in Jerusalem, I went to a friend's house as a journalist, a Palestinian journalist, and she had a Turkish flag on her wall. I mean,
wow.
this is a strategic move by Erdogan, I think. So to expect that he would publicly come out and say, don't go with a flotilla. That wouldn't play so well in Turkey. So, I guess I'm not surprised that Israel asked, but I haven't seen any response from Turkey
right. In
the stuff I've read lately.
Do you think there are any incentives for Turkey, maybe with their push to become part of the EU and the European Monetary Fund, to maybe help out Israel here? Is this not something that they're going to engage in?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, there's a couple of problems with the EU thing. First of all, I think maybe, I'm going to spend some time hopefully in Turkey this summer, so I may know more then. But I sense that Turkey is actually, the whole EU push is not as fervent as it was. And that, this whole sense of trying to be a hero to the Arab world may be a part of a strategy to just turn east. You know, France is a real adversary of Turkey in its attempts to get into the EU. One of the problems is with Turkey, in my view, is there's a lot of historical denial. I mean, historical denial, there's a lot of nations, including the United States, have lived with historical denial for generations, if not longer. And here you have the question of the Armenian massacre and the notion that Turkey won't acknowledge it, and in fact punishes those. Sometimes their own writers get sued and put on trial for statements they've made about the Armenian massacre, without Turkey's willingness to acknowledge something more than they have. I think their chances of getting to the EU are nil, and I don't see any movement in that direction. So then there's other questions that deal with perhaps prejudice that may be part of this as well. But I don't think the EU push is going to. I don't think they're going to be getting into the EU anytime soon. So I don't think this notion that they would help Israel so they could improve their efforts to get in the EU,
or just the international community in general.
Yeah. My guess is that's not what's at play here.
All right. One final question. The Goldstone Report. It has hit headline news once again. Does it deserve all this media attention?
Well, I think it's significant that Richard Goldstone essentially reversed himself. And, there's a lot of talk about what his motives were. I mean, there was an internal investigation by Israel conducted by a respected jurist, who is not Israeli, that he said, if I had access to this, then I wouldn't have said this. However, there were some details in that report that in his famous op-ed in The Washington Post, he seemed to ignore. So there's some question about, well, why did he do this now?
Yeah.
Did he feel genuinely ostracized? I mean, he was attacked, to the point where he almost didn't go to his nephew's bar mitzvah in South Africa. So he was really vilified. Did he feel like he wanted to make amends? I mean, I'm not in the man's mind or heart, so I don't know. But but I think that there's more to it than just another report that caused him to change his mind. I'm sure that contributed to it, but I think there's probably more at work here.
Sandy, thanks so much again for joining us today. This is Eye on the Middle East, broadcast live from the USC Annenberg Graduate School of Journalism.
Please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Just search for Neon Tommy, Eye on the Middle East. Thank you, and stay tuned for next week's podcast. And of course, take care.